Senior Focus.
Welcome everyone. I'm Anne-Marie Khoury. I'm your presenter today for Senior Focus. And with me in the studio, I have Mark Graham. And Mark is a very interesting person in terms of his background in architecture and housing. So he's a definite eye for what the city is going to look like in the future. He's standing as a candidate in Albert Eden Ward, for the councillor role. And so welcome, Mark.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And what we're about today is having a conversation around the growth and development in Auckland and whether communities are well connected and how people feel about living in their communities. And I know that one of the things that happens when you have an election upcoming is lots of people start turning up to lots of community meetings. And so it's in that space and on the social media space online that ideas start to gel. People start to have phrases that they trot out, and things gather momentum as to what the consensus is out there. And I know recently I was at a meeting where people were looking at the future of the town centre for Mount Roskill, and it was just quite fascinating to see how different age groups had different ideas and different ways of discussing their ideas. So I'd just like to ask you, Mark, what things you've been noticing in the recent times when you've been out and about in the community and also when you've been interacting with people?
Well, I think the most important thing that I've noticed is how much people really want to see a vibrant community around where they live in their neighbourhood. And they really do have a vested interest in making sure that where they live is a nice place to be. So that's a really wonderful and encouraging thing to see out there. Look, there's no doubt that the city is going to be changing quite dramatically over the next few years. We are growing hugely. 50,000 people a year are arriving into Auckland. And over the next 20 years or so, we're going to be seeing another million people living in Auckland. And we have to put them somewhere. And that's going to change our neighbourhoods.
Hmm. At the same time, we have the pressures coming from climate change and the big wake-up call. And the council, even in declaring a climate change emergency, is putting its pedal to the metal and really trying to move on this. And one of the things that really sort of, you know, comes out at me is the need for planning ahead carefully. So with building design, straight away you think, well, hang on, are we really using walls and roofs adequately? You know, are we actually greening places as we go?
Yes.
And then of course, another area is what's happened in recent times is the loss of tree cover, how critical that is, and how little protection there is for our trees.
There's a lot to unpack there. So the first thing is let's be perfectly clear here. Let's just acknowledge that it's happening, because there are still those people who don't really believe that it's happening and that it's not going to be bad. But it is, and unless we start to do something about it really urgently, it's going to get really bad in terms of heat and the effects that it's going to have on people, but also in terms of mass migration, where people living in those areas where they're not going to be able to live anymore are going to want to live somewhere else, and that will likely include New Zealand. We have to be prepared for that, and I don't think we are. Mm. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, what can we do about it now? There are three things that I see. The first thing is education. So we need to educate ourselves around what's going on and how to deal with it. The second thing is in minimization, so that we need to reduce our impact on the environment. That means we need to walk more and drive less. Driving is the number one thing, using our cars, which comes back to that whole importance of our neighbourhood, because if the stuff that we need is in our neighbourhood, we don't have to drive down the road to a supermarket. We can get it from our store around the corner. So there's minimization around our impact on the environment. And the third thing is mitigation. So the impact that is already out there, how do we actually deal with that? And how do we try to, reduce the impact that it's having out there? So, in terms of, building and our neighborhoods, mitigation is really going to be that thing, and minimization. And so if we can create those facilities around our neighborhoods that we want to be in and we want to hang out in, and we see our neighbors and really grow into a community, then that's going to be a positive thing. And around mitigation, it's around our built environment and making sure that what we build is actually has a minimal impact on the environment, the kind of materials that we use, the power that we're going to need to keep warm or cool, as the case may be, and the waste. Waste is a really big issue around building.
Indeed. Refurbishments, renovations and so on, there's a very high amount of stuff ending up at the landfill.
And with new builds as well. Mm. And, unfortunately it's not something that builders are really focused on, because nobody's putting pressure on them around that. But it's a problem. More than that, it's around, how do we put 1 million people into Auckland? And a lot of them are going to be coming through, my ward, especially Albert Eden, Pukitapapa. So this is like the isthmus, and that's a good place for people to be, because they can have access to a lot of the facilities that they need to without having to drive too far. So it's a good place for people to be. So it's how do we cater for all of these people coming in? Mm. And that includes things like, building sports fields for them and parks at places like Chamberlain Park, where there's currently a golf course. And I know it's a bit of a contentious issue, but, at the moment there's a few people who are using it for golf, but there's a lot more people that need it for sports fields and for just green space.
Mm. And on that note, I just was aware from the beginning when the plan came out, the concept plan for Chamberlain Park, I remember putting feedback in on it, that golf was still going to be permitted, that there was going to be a driving range, there was going to be support for golf in the
big
plan.
The big thing comes down for those guys to 9 holes versus 18 holes. Mm. And they're two completely different games. And 18 holes is, for the guys who play, for the people, I should say, who play golf, it's a big thing. And I get that. But New Zealand Golf actually came out with a report in 2013, and it identified the fact that golf as a sport worldwide and in New Zealand is being played less and less by fewer and fewer people. And not only that, but in Auckland itself, we actually have an oversupply of golf courses.
Mm.
So there's an abundance of places for people to go and play golf. And the argument then comes back, but Chamberlain Park, being a public golf course, is actually cheaper to play than any of the other courses. And, there's probably some truth to that. But Chamberlain Park is a jewel in the crown for the isthmus. And yet we cater for a relatively small number of people who are golfers to use it, whereas there's probably around about 250,000 people in Waitemata and Albert Eden Pukitapapa wards that are reasonably close to that park, who are very poorly serviced by green space right now. There are fewer parks per person in those two wards than in any other place in the whole country. So we need that green space to be used for other people as well. And unfortunately, we also have a real shortage of sports fields for kids, and there is no other place for them to go.
Mm. And there's two thoughts that sprang to mind as you spoke, Mark. One what happened when Boris Johnson got London, East London, transformed? He did it by focusing on open space. And the king of open space is a man called Sir Michael Marmot. He wasn't Sir Michael Marmot when he started the project, but he got knighted by the Queen for the work that he did in the project. He'd basically done research on 16 European cities, and it was a research that focused on the quality of open space and how it impacted on the quality of life and your life expectancy. And he was able to say categorically, you will die younger if you don't have access to quality open space.
Yep,
it's that simple.
Yep, well documented.
And if the ratio between the population per square metre of public space alters drastically, so will the life expectancy alter.
Yeah, well, and in fact, let me just do a little plug for the Cornwall Park. Now, let me think what it was. Cornwall Park Society, I think it is. They're having a seminar in a weekend or two around the benefits of being having access to open spaces and parklands and so forth. So that's coming up soon. It's on Facebook if people want to jump in and have a look at the Cornwall Park Society. It's great. But yeah, I mean, these things are important. They are important for us, and they do add to the positive aspects of a neighbourhood is having greenery and trees, and you know, and of course that rolls into the whole loss of tree canopy across Auckland as well. When National changed the laws around being able to get rid of large trees, a lot of people started cutting trees down in their backyards, and we've lost 30% of our tree canopy across Auckland. Notwithstanding the million trees that we've planted over the last 2.5 years.
Yes, and the difficulty is in size and dimension as to how these trees impact on water quality, air quality. If you want to get the real benefits, you need to have large trees that are 30 metres and more.
Yep.
And it's those trees that are the ones that have actually received more of the attention and from developers.
Yeah.
And have been least protected. And protection has resided solely on the listed trees.
Yep. And of course, it's going to take a really long time for those new trees to come back to that size.
Mm, well, exactly. But there were, at the time of the super city and a lot of, there wasn't enough awareness about the importance of these particular trees, so that not every large tree was actually on the notable list registered,
yeah.
And so there weren't enough registered.
But
so
at least there used to be that blanket ban that any exotic tree over 8 meters or any native tree over 6 meters was basically protected. You have to jump through hoops to be able to cut it down.
Mm.
Not the case anymore. You can basically cut down anything on your property that you want. And unfortunately, we've lost 30% of our tree cover. That's quite remarkable.
It is indeed. And I think as well as that, there's been loopholes in the unitary plan. The unitary plan, it had rules, but there wasn't sort of clear enforceableness. There wasn't a measurement. There wasn't follow through. And so you could drive a bus through the provisions in the unitary plan, and literally it was really easier for people to chop trees.
Well, I think now that the unitary plan has been in place for a couple of years, council is looking at going back and reviewing it, looking at what's working and what's not working. So we're going to be going through that process over the next couple of years. And I think one of the most important things, and one issue that I'm really, really hot on, is around the quality of what gets built out there. So Housing NZ especially has a huge responsibility, because they own 28,000 properties across Auckland, 66,000 properties nationally, but 28,000 properties in Auckland alone. And just around the corner from me in Point Sheriff, they've taken off a duplex on a corner site, so that's two dwellings, and they've put seven houses in there. Now, that's all good. We need those houses. sensors, nothing wrong with those going in there. But I have some real concerns around the design that has happened there. And in fact, I'm meeting with Housing NZ tomorrow to look through a new development that they've got in Avondale. And I'm going to be raising those issues with them. And the question comes down to how best can we ensure that quality design is brought into everything that developers do generally, but Housing NZ especially does in the future?
Very succinct question, because it is critical for the well-being of people in the future, and if not now. So
there's two aspects to it, you know. So you know, we've already touched on how important parkland and trees are to us, but the built environment, the stuff that we live in, is obviously important because we're immersed in it. So if you build with poor design where it doesn't get sunlight and you don't have that opportunity to actually commune with your neighbours and have that sense of community and belonging, you have a situation where you're isolated from people. That's really bad to your sense of well-being. And the other thing is that if you build in materials that aren't high quality and they start to deteriorate, sometimes quite quickly, then you end up with buildings that are actually physically unhealthy as well. So you get spiritual unhealthiness and physical unhealthiness in a space where, you know, you don't have any kind of offsetting by greenery. Now, you know, you've got real problems there.
And that was exactly what Boris Johnson was trying to get rid of in East London. Lots and lots of buildings that weren't serving their purpose, that weren't healthy environments, and that people were not living in a connected way.
Well, I never knew that he actually did something decent, because at the moment he's on a path to bloody nowhere, that's for sure.
Well, yes, we won't go there. But,
are you a Brexit fan?
No. But I'm just sort of thinking that this has got to be a local homegrown conversation.
Indeed, yep.
But at the moment, I think one of the issues with the housing, that I've seen some brilliant Housing New Zealand designs. I've been through some of the new builds, some of the terraced housing on Northcote, for example, designed by Rewi Thompson, the Māori architect who's since passed.
Rewi.
He just did brilliant work.
Yep, I was
and
at
these
his funeral.
Are fabulous
sad,
places.
Sad loss.
Yes, indeed. The difficulty for me in looking at these was, I was thinking there's still too much concrete in the environment.
Concrete actually is an interesting thing, because it has an enormous impact on the environment. It's one of the greatest contributors to CO2. In our environment, and also we're actually running short of sand worldwide. We're running out of sand. Hard to believe, isn't it?
Now, that's a very interesting point, Mark. But I was about to say that some very clued up, bright young students came to us from university in our Poki Te Papa board at a workshop, and they explained some research they'd done into concrete, and they compared the amount of runoff on sections covered with concrete compared with people whose garden areas and driveways had used those impervious tiles where grass can grow through, and where there can be a proper, you know, seepage down into the water table, so that water doesn't run off onto the stormwater and down the road. So they illustrated that some of the problems of the stormwater being overloaded in Auckland is due to the amount of coverage by concrete all over yards and driveways.
Well, this brings up an interesting point around the future of our built environment and what are we going to do, because at the moment you're not allowed to recycle grey water or rainwater in Auckland City. Which is remarkably stupid. You know, you can't, you know, you can water your garden with it, but you can't flush your toilet with grey water. And that's just a nonsense. It just encourages us to use fresh, clean water that we should be, potable water that we should be drinking or cooking with or bathing with to flush our toilets, which, you know, where's the point in that? We don't know exactly what's going to happen with Auckland's climate. There is some speculation that we may end up with like a wet season and a dry season. If we have a dry season, I mean, look at the winter that we've had so far. You know, the dams in Auckland are down to around about 60%. So if that's the case, and that's going to be a regular thing, there's every chance that we could go back into the drought that we had back in the 1990s. I don't know if you remember that. You know, the old don't wash your car and plant a tree instead. You know, if it's brown, flush it down. But if it's yellow, let it mellow. Do you remember that? You know, that was, we just had the most wonderful winter, but wasn't good for our water supply. So if that's going to be the case on an ongoing basis, A, we need more dams. B, we need to look at how we recycle water. And that runoff is, you know, just throwing it away. It's just stupid.
These are really big questions, and I know the water strategy has been out for consultation, and that's got some interesting things in it, because we can't just keep taking more water from the Waikato River, and so there needs to be a mechanism whereby we can recycle water. And that has got to be built in, and it's disgusting.
And minimisation of waste as well.
Yes.
You know,
and
how
people
much
actually, in Australia, I noticed in a lot of places where I've travelled, they actually use buckets in their showers. They actually retain the shower water, surplus shower water, and then they use that on the garden.
Right.
And that is normalised as good behaviour.
Wow.
Good societal behaviour, which
well, imagine capturing that water from the drain so that you don't just get what's in the bucket, but you get all of it, and it goes into an enormous bucket that you then run a hose from, and that goes into the garden. Mm. And, you know, you have to ask, why aren't we doing that? That's just remarkable to me.
And I think, really, we really need to have environmentally friendly businesses that show leadership, and there needs to be incentivising.
Yes.
And incentivising to stop stuff going to the landfill, incentivising to get good design in place.
Yes.
And prioritise that.
Yep.
And I know that there's universal design section in Auckland Council, and they do fantastic work. The key thing that they have come up with is that buildings should be accessible, and they should be designed in a manner that they're going to suit all ages right through the lifespan, so that people can move in and out of different houses. Yes, they'll move house, but the house will be automatically user-friendly to those who need accessibility.
Yeah, well, in fact, that's something that is being encouraged into new houses that are being built, so that, in fact, as you grow with your house can cater for your needs. So, you know, if you have an accident and end up in a wheelchair, for instance, or if you just grow older and a bit more infirm, that you are able to live in that house for as long as you can independently. And it's voluntary at the moment, but increasingly becoming a basic requirement of new houses.
Indeed. And I think there's still a gap between what we know is best practice and what is actually happening. And it's in that gap that we need leadership from local government and central government. We need the incentives. And those incentives have got to become, you know, powerful carrots to get people to move in the direction we want them to move in.
Well, you know, you bring up an interesting point, because the city is going to transform over the next 20 years. So we actually have this really enormous opportunity to create something that's much better than even what we have now. Now, if you have a look around some of the housing, especially some of the old Housing NZ buildings around Pukitapapa, around Mount Roskill and Wesley and Owairaka, you know, some of those buildings are terrible, especially the stuff built in the 60s, 70s, 80s. Mm. So to rebuild them using modern building techniques where they're warm and well-built and built to last a long time, and built for a future that's coming our way, whether we like it or not, you know, we can really create something that's going to be a fantastic place to live.
Oh, yes. And we're seeing pockets of this. I was aware that an agency called Vision West, obviously out in the Waitakere area in Glen Eden, they have been building houses for people who find it very difficult to get into accommodation, people who are out of prison or whatever. Now, some of these houses, they are triple glazed. They have fantastic insulation above the building code standard. And all the supplies were donated. Students from the Polytech, carpentry students and so on, were actually part of the program.
Let me just jump in here very quickly, all right? Sorry to...
But
okay. You brought up the fact that these houses are built above building code. You know, mm-hmm. I publish in the building industry
right.
a building guide. And brands who are in charge of standards out there did some research about 18 months ago asking why more people don't build above building code. Because you don't have to just build to building code, you can actually build better, which means that you can actually put more insulation in your house and have a warmer house. And they went, why aren't more people doing that? And you know what their answer was? People don't know that they can. So if you are building or renovating, then make sure that you actually put additional insulation in.
Indeed.
Because it makes your house better. And that goes back to these guys coming out of prison, going into safe, warm, well-built environments where they can actually feel well.
The thing is, these places look fantastic, and people walking past have often knocked on the door and asked people living in the home, how do you get one of these?
Yeah, brilliant.
And, of course, they don't really want to perhaps tell their story.
Yeah.
But the fact is that they wouldn't have picked it as social housing. It didn't have that social housing look that everybody would expect.
Yeah.
It was a very desirable place, and that's the future, I think, of that type of housing.
Yep.
It's not going to look ugly. It's not going to be, not in my backyard, we don't want them.
Yep.
No, people will want these in their neighbourhoods.
That's marvellous.
Mm. Thank you very much for coming in, Mark.
It's a pleasure.
We look forward to having you on our program again.
Yeah, well, I'm looking
soon.
Forward to it. Yep, very
yes,
much so.
Because there's a lot to talk about in terms of the election and in terms of what choices we're making and what sort of people we're going to be having as leaders.
Yeah, well, I guess if I could just leave one last thought with people, and that is that change is coming at us. Mm. You know, whether we like it or not. Change is coming, whether it's environment or whether it's population growth or new technologies that are coming at us that are going to change how we get about and how we live our lives. So the question is, who are we going to put in place to make decisions about how those changes are dealt with? And that's a key thing, you know, being able to trust the people to make good decisions around the future.
Great. I couldn't agree more. And thank you again for coming in and sharing some of your thoughts with us about this topic.
Thanks for having me on.
Great.
Thanks, Anne-Marie.
And we're going to have a track now, a jazz track that I'm quite fond of, and I'll let you sit back and enjoy, and we'll be back on air in a week. Thank you.